In these morning talks, I'm mostly focusing on practical teachings that are the fundamental teachings for meditation in Buddhism. And we began by talking about mindfulness and contentment, situational awareness. And then we moved on to discussing the five hindrances, and we've talked about each of these hindrances and ways of dealing with them and overcoming them in our practice. Now, for the remainder of these talks, then I would like to focus on another group of teachings, which is the five indriyas, or five spiritual faculties. And these have come up a couple of times in the retreat so far. I've already referred to them a few times. We've already heard I spoke about the idea of the indriya, the idea of a spiritual faculty as being a potential that one has that becomes supercharged through one's spiritual practice. And we talked yesterday, we saw how, was it yesterday? No, the day before yesterday, we saw how these faculties were originally inherited from the teachers that the Buddha had before he was enlightened. So the five spiritual faculties are, can anyone tell me? Faith. Energy or effort? Yes, good. Mindfulness. Yes, but no. But yes, samadhi, thank you. And? Devotion. That's faith. And? Wisdom. Okay, very good. Okay, so faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about each one of these. And faith, to begin with, because actually we only have a few days left on the retreat, we don't have enough time to talk about all of these in as much detail as we should, but anyway, so faith is the starting point of our practice, and faith in Buddhism has both an emotional and a cognitive component, so it both means both an inner sense of like a delight or a joy, like it has this positive emotional connotation. But it's a positive emotional connotation that's actually connected with some meaningful content. And the first thing that gives rise to faith in Buddhism is suffering. Because you suffer and it hurts and it's bad and you don't like it. And then the Buddha comes along and says, hey, you're suffering, right? And you go, yeah, that's me. I'm suffering. The Buddha's talking to me. Fantastic. Oh, maybe he's got something worthwhile listening to. So this is the arising of faith in Buddhism. When you realize that the Buddha is actually talking about something that's meaningful for your life, and he's not coming along and trying to convert you or make you belong to his doctrine or anything like that. He's trying to help you understand the suffering in your life so that you can let go of it. And that's the basis of faith in Buddhism. And the Buddha was very clear that the faith that he's talking about is a reasoned faith. That means a faith which is based on experience and a faith which is tested. So in Buddhism and in Eastern religions and Eastern philosophies generally, we don't have the dichotomy between faith and reason, which you find in Western philosophy. And I think one of the things which I find quite disappointing is that in certain forms of modern Buddhism and modern Buddhist practice, that they don't seem to realize this. And so rather than realizing, actually Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings, and again, just to reiterate, it's not just Buddhism. It's actually common to Jainism, Hinduism, even Taoism, have similar ideas that there isn't the divide between faith and reason, which is so characteristic of Western philosophy. And so, unfortunately, some people in the West don't seem to realize this, and so they re-import this Western division into Buddhism and adopt a sort of hypercritical, hyper-rational approach to Buddhism, rather than using Buddhism to heal that split, which never should have been there in the first place. There is no split between faith and reason. A scientist who does an experiment does it out of faith, and a scientist must take countless things on faith. They have to believe that the world is real. They have to believe that the science that they learnt at school is more or less true. They have to believe that this experiment may tell them something interesting about the subject that they're looking at. They have to believe all of these different things that they've read in textbooks. And they have to believe all of these things, but the point is that it's a reasoned faith, because if they do the experiment and they find that something shows that one of their beliefs was in fact incorrect, then they can go back and correct that. Right? So it's not that they don't have faith, it's that they don't have absolute faith. That's what is the root of the problem. So in Buddhism, faith is exactly the same. We hear the Buddha teaching, we have a reasoned confidence in what the Buddha says, and we put it into practice. And if you come along and you meditate, and you find that meditation just makes you feel bad and doesn't give you any peace, then fine, reject the Buddha's teachings. It's all right. You're not like a heretic for doing that. You tried? Good. You had the faith, you gave it a go. But I think most of us will find that if we put that application in, try out the Buddha's teachings and test them, we find actually there is something to it. We can't, of course, necessarily confirm everything immediately, right? Any more than a scientist can confirm everything immediately, right? They can confirm this one thing, okay? Then we go on to the next thing. We do the same thing. We put this into practice. We try to understand our own minds. We try to understand how all of this works. And we ask ourselves that one simple question. The faith of the Buddha is predicated on the idea that if we practice the Buddha's teachings, we can let go of suffering. And if we can let go of a little bit of suffering from following that teaching, then that's enough to confirm that and to give us faith in the Buddha's teaching, enough faith to take the next step. Yeah? This is faith. So the faith is a starting point. It's not an ending point. And in fact, in Buddhism, there's a number of dialogues that point to the fact that somebody who has experience doesn't need faith anymore. For example, there's a lovely dialogue between Citta Gahapati Buddha, a prominent householder in the time of the Buddha, and the leader of the Jains, Nigantha Nataputta. And once Nigantha Nataputta was said to Citta, he said, "Do you go by faith in the Buddha? Do you believe the Buddha? Do you have faith in him when he says that it's possible to reach a state of samadhi where the mind is very completely unified?" And Citta says, "No, I don't go by faith in the Buddha when he says that." And Nigantha Nataputta says to his disciples, he says, see, even his own followers don't believe what the Buddha says. And Citta says, yes, I don't go by faith in the Buddha because I myself practice that kind of samadhi and attain it whenever I want. So I don't have any need to have any faith in the Buddha for that. And Nigantha Nataputta was like, see how deceitful and untrustworthy these followers of the Buddha are? So this is the point. The point of Buddhism is that somebody who has perfected their faith in Buddhism, right, is a stream enterer because they've seen the Dhamma for themselves. And a stream enterer is described as being someone who is aparapachaya, who is not dependent on another. So the purpose of Buddhism is not to make a bunch of sort of mindless acolytes who will just blindly follow the word of the leader, right? The purpose is so that you can find the truth for yourself, right? And so and as long as our path is leading us in that direction, then our faith is guiding us correctly. But it's always to be questioned, and it's always to be applied very carefully and very mindfully. So there is that emotional component to the faith, right? That kind of joy and that kind of confidence that comes with the mind and with the heart when you found something that you can believe in and that you can trust. But then we also apply that and we try to figure it out and to practice it. So this is the faith as according to Buddhism. Now the second quality in the five indriyas is the quality of energy. And energy arises naturally from faith, right? Obviously, if we have some faith in what the Buddha's talking about, we're ready to put that into practice. We're ready to start doing it. And if we lose faith, then it's very hard for us to put any kind of effort into our practice. So we start making an effort. An effort in Buddhism is always defined as being the effort to let go of what is unwholesome and to develop what is wholesome. So coming here to do this meditation retreat, you're all putting in a lot of effort. You've all made the effort to let go of all of your attachments, all of the things in your life, and you've made an effort to come here and to spend time devoted to meditation and keeping precepts and so on. This all is part of your right effort. So effort doesn't only mean like forcing yourself to stay awake long hours or something like that. I mean, sometimes you do have to make yourself stay awake longer than you want to. Sometimes you do have to sort of struggle a bit in your practice. But it's important to notice that effort is not just those things. You're already making an effort just by being here, just by staying awake, just by being on the meditation cushion. That's your right effort. So that effort and that energy is what sustains us and what propels us forward, acting out of our faith. So the faith under the faith also has an understanding of the Buddha's teachings. We apply that, and then we start to see the results. So faith and energy, and the next one of these qualities is mindfulness. And mindfulness is, we've talked about mindfulness, you know, a reasonable amount already in the retreat, so I won't spend too long on it here. But the basic quality of mindfulness is the basic function of mindfulness is to retain something in mind, to keep in mind. So this is why it's connected with memory. So when you're meditating, if you're watching your breath, then keeping your breath in mind, this is what the mindfulness is. It's that in your mind which maintains a continuity of awareness. Yeah? And so when you're practicing, you have faith to practice, to apply the Buddha's teachings, you come, you meditate, you put an effort into doing that, and then you keep on doing that, and you keep on applying your mind consistently and persistently to that, and this is where the mindfulness comes in. So mindfulness has been discussed so much, and everyone's written long books about it, including me. I plead guilty to that. And one of the interesting things about mindfulness is, of course, these days it's very distinctively regarded as a Buddhist thing, but we saw in the Buddha's reference to Alarika Lama and Uttaka Ramaputta that he actually practiced mindfulness under them. And we also, another account which we didn't look at, but the account of the Buddha's self-mortifications under the Jains, or in a Jain-like practice, that he also mentioned practicing mindfulness in that context as well. So it seems that the practice of mindfulness was quite widespread before the time of the Buddha. It's not a uniquely Buddhist thing. Again, that doesn't mean to say that the Buddhist practice of mindfulness is identical with those other practices, but it's just to say that it's sort of drawing that inspiration, and certainly the Buddha never really claimed that mindfulness was something that was distinctive and unique to his particular path. Now, in modern times, it is common to equate mindfulness, or the idea of mindfulness, with the idea of just being aware of whatever comes up, and it's common to equate that with what they call vipassana. Neither of these things are found in the suttas. Mindfulness is not, in the suttas, particularly closely associated with vipassana. On the contrary, mindfulness is much more closely associated with samadhi and with bringing the mind to a state of peace. An obvious example of that is breath meditation, which we call anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And that's the point, is that we watch our breath in order to get into samadhi. So the connection between mindfulness and vipassana is something that we find only mentioned in a few places. Of course, you know, the Buddha's teaching is such that ultimately everything relates to everything else. So, of course, there is a connection between those things. But if you look in all of the great collections of suttas dealing with vipassana meditation, in the Kanda Samyutta, the Dhatu Samyutta, the Salayatana Samyutta, and so on, where there are hundreds and hundreds of suttas talking about vipassana, you don't find a single mention of mindfulness in all of those suttas. So this is very much a modern phenomenon that certain modern teachers have, for various complicated historical reasons that I won't go into, have decided that mindfulness is essentially identical with vipassana. So again, you know, if you're following the practices in those teachings, then that's fine. You can just, you know, understand it as the way that they explain it, but it's important not to back-read those understandings into the suttas. And as we pointed out in a number of cases, that there are words and terms and ideas that are common in later Theravada Buddhism that are not found in the suttas, and this is one of those ideas. So in the suttas, mindfulness is regarded as the samadhi nimitta, so that the four satipatthanas, the four foundations or four kinds of mindfulness meditation are regarded as the samadhi nimitta. And I mentioned yesterday that the word nimitta does not mean a bright light that you see in meditation, not in the suttas. The word nimitta means a quality or something that when you practice it or pay attention to it, then it gives rise to similar and related qualities. So in this context, we could call it a basis. So samadhi, mindfulness practice is the basis of samadhi. And again, this is just restating what we ordinarily understand in the context of breath meditation. We practice mindfulness of breathing in order to get into samadhi. That's what that phrase means. And this is a general statement about the practice of mindfulness. So the primary purpose, the main purpose of mindfulness practice is to lead to samadhi, to lead to peace of mind. How does it do that? Well, it does that because our minds are normally diverse and fractured. We're thinking about things all the time. Memories are coming here and there. Senses are going here and there. Our minds are full of defilements and hindrances and all of those things, which I'm sure you've all got very familiar with over the past several days. So when we are mindful of something, we keep our awareness with that thing. We maintain the continuity of thing. The more we do that, then the more the mind comes to a oneness, the more the mind is unified. And that is what the Buddha meant when he said, "Ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo," that the satipatthana or the foundations of mindfulness or the kinds of mindfulness meditation are the path to convergence, the path to the place where all things come together as one. So when you're meditating, think about this. When you're meditating, if you're doing metta meditation or you're doing breath meditation or whatever other kind of meditation that you do, and your mind starts to think, right? You're sitting here meditating, your mind starts to think. That's telling you something profoundly profound about what's happening in your meditation. It means that you already have a vantage point from which you can see that the mind is thinking. Normally our mind is just thinking and we don't even notice it. We're just swept up in it. We've fallen into the stream and we're swept away by it. When you have something to be mindful of, then you can start to see it. And for the first time, you're realizing that your mind is so chaotic, that your mind is so out of control. And you see this again and again and again. And the fact that you see it is good. That's an essential part of the path. And if we keep going, gradually, 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 you'll learn to let go of that. And I'm sure this has happened to many, if not most of the people on the retreat so far, that at one point or another, you realize, oh, my mind is peaceful. And that state of being peaceful is actually very close. Peace is not something so very far away. Peace just happens when you let go. You can find peace right there, just while you're sitting there. You just stop. And if your awareness is focused, and you just know that one thing in the state of stillness, then everything is gone and you're mindful in the present. And then that's peace. It's not so very far away. So this is this practice of mindfulness, which is the foundation for developing samadhi. Which then brings us on to the fourth of these indriyas, which is samadhi or immersion. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But the idea of samadhi, again, I'll just discuss it fairly briefly now. I don't want to get too much into the technical details, but in the suttas, we have a number of terms that refer to more or less the same kind of thing. The most important ones are samadhi, jhana, and also samatha. They basically mean the same kind of thing. A slight difference on emphasis is that samatha has more emphasis on the process. So samatha we usually translate as tranquility or serenity or calm, and that's more about the process and the sort of a bit more general process leading to tranquility. Then we have the word samadhi, which is used for a profound state of immersion in meditation, and the word jhana, which in the suttas is usually used in a technical sense for four particular states of samadhi. Now, in all important doctrinal contexts, samadhi is defined as the four jhanas. So there are a few places where the word samadhi is used a little bit more broadly than that, but they are usually either in verses or in some slightly unusual contexts. So for the most part in the suttas, when they use the word samadhi, they just mean the same thing as the four jhanas. And I mentioned briefly last night that the word samadhi and jhanas actually have similar meanings or similar senses, in that they both convey two senses. One is of a state of mind that's still and peaceful, and then the other one is of something burning or illuminated. So they both convey these two kind of senses. So in the Brahmanical traditions, samadhi is considered to be the final state realized by a sage, and is felt to be the union of the self, the small Atman in here, with the divinity of the cosmos. It's very profound. And the Buddhist tradition has always agreed with that, and the Buddhist tradition has always said that the essential idea of what we're talking about as samadhi is the same thing that the Brahmins were talking about. We've never disputed that. The Buddha practiced samadhi under his former teachers. That's where he learnt those practices. As we have heard already, that he also experienced these states just purely naturally as a child, but he certainly, the Buddhist tradition has always acknowledged that these practices were shared with the Brahmanical traditions. The difference is, of course, not the state of meditation, but the philosophy and the way of understanding it. So we don't understand that in a metaphysical way as being like a union with the divine, but we understand it in a purely psychological sense as being where certain mental states have been abandoned, namely the five hindrances, and certain other mental states have been developed, i.e. the positive factors that we're developing, like the five indriyas, or more specifically, the five jhana factors. So the state of samadhi or state of jhana is a state of peace that emerges from the practice of deep mindfulness. And samadhi is something which is very profound and very transformative. It happens when you let go, and it's characterized by unification. And I understand unification as having a number of different dimensions, all of which are intended and all of which are implied in this context. So samadhi means unification of mind in the sense of one consciousness. So when the Buddha talked about consciousness, he always talked about a multitude of consciousnesses: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. Obviously, if there are many consciousnesses, then it's not unified. So there's one consciousness, which is mind consciousness only. So this is the first aspect of unification in samadhi. Second aspect of unification in samadhi is that unification means that mind is aware. It's not only just mind consciousness, but it's also mind consciousness which is aware of one thing only. So the mind is not aware of one thing and then another thing and then another thing. So this is not samadhi. So again, some modern teachers will sort of describe states that they call a state of samadhi where you're being mindful of one object after another. And this is not what samadhi means in the suttas. So samadhi means mind consciousness only. It means mind consciousness which is aware of one thing only. But it's not just unification in the sense of those unifying of those different kinds of consciousness. It's also unification in time. And this is critical to the whole idea of samadhi and why it works and why it functions as it does, both in the Buddhist path and also in its metaphysical interpretations. Time, according to Buddhism, is what we call an upadaya panyati, is a derived concept. So time is not something which is an absolute or a given in the universe. It's a concept which is originated in the minds of beings that reflect on it. What is it originated from? Well, time, the concept of time is originated from change. So things change, and we therefore we think of that as time. But what is change? Well, change actually is changes in consciousness. Right? So again, just think about it in a very simple way. If I'm watching a clock and I see the second hands ticking on the clock, that's how I know that time has changed, because I am aware, I am conscious of the movement of the hands on the clock. Right? So time is a derived concept which is inferred from changes in consciousness. However, that's also not a complete definition, because the changes of the, if you look at a clock, if you look at the second hand changing on a clock, you can't actually see that change, because your eyes are in the present. All you can see is that the second hand is at this point. Then you can see that the second hand is at this point. And then you can see that the second hand is at this point. But your eyes can't see that the second hand is changing. Change requires you to remember that the second hand used to be at that point. So the concept of change requires a mental processing of that information. And that's what memory does. Right? So we have memory which understands it used to be here, then it's there, then it's there. Right? So time, according to Buddhism, is a derived concept which is inferred from our memory of changes in consciousness. Yeah? Absolutely, yeah. So anicca, because of that, anicca is something that can only ultimately be inferred. Yeah, it's not something you can directly infer. Impermanence is something that you can't actually directly observe. You can only observe actually how things are now. Of course, when we talk about memory in this context, we're not talking about memory in the sense of, do you remember what you had for breakfast this morning, right? You're talking about a much more immediate processing of things. But still, the idea of consciousness consciousness is not just sliced up in the present moment. Consciousness is actually built in a fuzzy way that organically knits together the past and the future, right? And so this is work that's not done by the eye, so you don't see it. It's done by the mind. So it's a concept which is originated in consciousness. So once again, time is a concept which is inferred from our memory of the changes of consciousness. Now, if you're in meditation, if you come back to samadhi, you're in deep meditation, your mind is not changing. Remember the last one, you just have one kind of consciousness, and that consciousness is only aware of one thing. So there's no change. So that means there's no time. Light. Yeah, light, bliss, oneness. Yeah. No, not by that point, yeah. Although it's not the breath, because all of those things are part of the breath, right? So when you're meditating, you don't experience it as saying, now I'm aware of the breath, and now I'm aware of this other thing, because that's two things. Yeah? So the point is that inside the breath is not just a physical thing, but the breath also is something which is a concept, because there's a direct physical impression that we get from the breath, but there's also our mind's idea of what the breath contains. So when you go into meditation, actually what we call the nimitta, or the light in breath, is originated from perception. And it's actually inside that concept of the breath all along. So it's not like you stop paying attention to the breath and start paying attention to a light. It's that the breath reveals the fact that it had light in it all along. That's how it's experienced in meditation. Yeah. What, sorry, which one? What is the pulse? The pause. Oh, the pause. What about that? What does that mean? What does it mean? Yeah, at this point, the point that we're talking about, you don't see that at all. So you don't see anything like the in-breath and the out-breath and all of these kinds of things. And the pauses between them. Like early in the meditation you do, but you're penetrating through to something which is like a hidden dimension. Yeah? It's the same thing. It's the same thing, but it's inside the breath. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like it must be more to the feeling of time, or inferring time from the number of changes in consciousness. I'm not sure, I'm not so deep in it, but I know that there are drugs that you take them and they make your time awareness. So they prolong it, like, really.
Right.
You feel 3 hours have passed,
but
in reality it's 5 minutes.
Right. They're changing your consciousness.
But how do you explain that? If they don't increase your intensity.
Well, I'm not sure why that's a problem. You take the drugs, they change your brain, it changes your consciousness, and that changes your perception of time. That's exactly what I mean by that. I didn't say it's the number of changes, I just said it's dependent on the change of consciousness. Okay, we'll leave it now. I think let it sit for a little while and then we can talk about it later if you want to, huh? So just come back to the idea that I was getting to. So this is the idea of unification in time. So nothing is changing. And this is why when people have this experience, then they come out of the experience and they say, that was God. I've just become one with God. This is something which does not die. This lasts forever. Because in that experience, there's no such thing as time. And for the person in that experience, has no idea how much time passes. Now, a person outside of that experience can look at them and can see. I mean, typically, a samadhi experience, you can't generalize about these things too much because they do vary, you know, from person to person and experience to experience. But generally speaking, it will last for quite a long time. We already saw in the Upakilesa Sutta how the Buddha emphasized that he would practice these different states of samadhi all day or all night or all night and day. And so these things, typically when the mind becomes very still in samadhi, then these states will last for a long period of time. So this is my understanding of what unification means and what oneness and samadhi means. So this is a profound state where the mind is free of all hindrances, free of all the senses. Right? So this is what it says at the beginning of the jhana formula, viviceva kamehi, is free from the senses. Vivicca akusalehi dhammehi, free from unwholesome dhammas. And the mind goes into that very kind of deep state. I won't talk too much about the different kind of jhana states and so on right now, but just to give you a general idea of what the Buddha was talking about when he's talking about samadhi. What about space and samadhi? Can you be more specific? Can you... Right. Right. Yeah, and then I mean you see that in especially in the Arupas where you have this kind of idea of infinite space and so on. So yeah, definitely it's connected. And the idea there, I think it certainly does. Yeah, good question. The idea of both space and time being relative is, I believe, first found in the Buddhist suttas. Right? So it obviously doesn't talk about relatively in exactly the same way that Einstein does, but it does have that idea. Right? We have passages where time, the passage of time is relative. It'll move at different speeds for different people. The idea of space being relative as well is also something that we find there. So, for example, you have like Rohitasa, the deva who's trying to go across all of space and can't reach the end of it. And the Buddha says, yeah, well, that's a kind of a stupid way to go across space, but instead you understand what's happening inside your own mind and body. So, yeah, look, I don't know if I can sort of spell it out in too much more detail than that, but there's certainly inside a state of samadhi, then there's that state of, there's like a feeling of like the dropping of boundaries and divisions. Yeah. Right. Well, I would say that from early Buddhist perspective is that there isn't that strong distinction between subject and object in the first place. So from the point of view of early Buddhism, that the primary reality, like philosophically, the primary reality in early Buddhism is not a subject, it's not an object, it's not a material world or an idealistic world. The primary reality is conditions, is dependent origination. And our primary reality in terms of our mind is our relation. It's all of this stuff. It's seeing things and hearing things and responding to them, having emotions and all of this mixed up kind of thing. That's our primary reality. And so from a Buddhist point of view, what we do is we start from that and we then draw out different aspects so we can understand what's going on. So we draw out distinctions between mind and matter. We draw out distinctions between subject and object, if you like. We draw out distinctions between past, present, and future. And these are all kind of ways of looking at and understanding that reality. But it's not like this is this is something which is derived, and these things are more fundamental. In fact, the fundamental thing, the primary thing, is this mess which we are confronted with. Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about four of the five indriyas so far, and some of the topics that we've brought up we'll discuss more in the talks in the coming nights, but I just wanted to give a brief summary of those four, and I'll talk about the wisdom faculty tomorrow. Okay. Why? Why? Because I'm hoping that I've kind of blown your minds just a little bit. And I'm wanting you to sit with that for a while. Am I right? No? Maybe not? Okay, maybe not. All right. So you can sit with that for a while, and then we'll talk about wisdom tomorrow.